Tonight's topic is catching the spirit of Jewish spirituality, and I wanted to begin by sharing with you a passage from a book by Roger Kamenetz, who I've mentioned a few times in the past, his famous book, Jew in the Lotus, where he shares the following observation. Kamenetz says, "The house of Judaism in North America has not been satisfactorily built. It does not have a spiritual dimension for many Jews. For too many Jews, like myself, our Jewishness has been an incoherent mixture of nostalgia, family feeling, group identification, a smattering of Hebrew, a concern for Israel, and so forth. The vicarious relationship to Israel as a cause will not sustain Jewish affiliation in the long term, any more than devotion to other Jewish causes such as civil rights, social equality, and combating anti-Semitism." In a famous book written by Alan Dershowitz called The Vanishing American Jew, I suspect that in America he includes all of North America, Dershowitz profiles his intermarried son as someone for whom Judaism is not even a faith, but basically a cultural heritage. There was a book written not long ago by Farinak Margolies. I think I'm pronouncing her name properly. Her book is called Off the Derech. It's a book that basically speaks about the growing phenomena of Jews who are not connecting with Judaism. Specifically, her focus is on traditional Jews, Jews who grew up in homes where the Torah was observed, and yet people from these families are leaving Judaism in great numbers. So in her book, she asks a number of people, she does a tremendous amount of polling, and she asks a very simple question: did your community foster spirituality? 46% said no. 31% said somewhat. Only 24% of the people Jews interviewed said that their communities fostered any kind of spirituality. That's less than 75%. It's actually more than 75% reporting that their communities did not strongly foster any kind of spiritual life. There's a wonderful Jew that is living today. He actually is someone who connected with Judaism only later in life. His name is Arthur Kurzweil, a very wonderful teacher. He's a magician. He uses magic to demonstrate the magic of Judaism and the mystery of Judaism. And he became very close with one of the world's leading Jewish thinkers, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. And he wrote a wonderful book about an opportunity he had for many years to actually drive Rabbi Steinsaltz all over when Rabbi Steinsaltz came from Israel to visit in North America. The book was aptly titled On the Road with Rabbi Steinsaltz. And he basically recounts many of the conversations and discussions he had with his spiritual mentor. One of the most disturbing passages in the book is where Kurzweil shares the following observation. He says, "In my conversations with rabbis of all denominations over the years, it is clear that many of them have an aversion to spirituality, even sometimes claiming that Judaism is not really spiritual." This is coming from rabbis. Sylvia Borstein, a famous Jewish bubbi, a grandmother who is a traditional Jew but teaches Buddhist meditation, in a wonderful book she wrote called Funny, You Don't Look Buddhist, she asked the question, why are Jews so interested in Buddhism? And one of the people that responds to this question is Jonathan Omerman, who had led a school, I think it may even still exist in California, that focused on Jewish meditation for many years. Jonathan Omerman responded, "Jews are interested in Buddhism because it's a complete, mature, and sophisticated spiritual path." Obviously, these Jews who were so interested in Buddhism as a complete and mature and sophisticated spiritual path didn't have that impression of Judaism. Sarah Yocheved Rigler, who is today one of the Jewish community's best-selling authors, she wrote Holy Woman, Lights from Jerusalem, recently published When God Whispers, I think is her latest book, spent 17 years of her life on a Hindu ashram, and when she was asked in an interview not long ago, why did she spend so many years of her life as a Hindu, what didn't work for her growing up Jewishly, she reported that there were two things missing from her Jewish upbringing. One was God and one was growth. She didn't experience Judaism as any kind of path to spiritual growth, and she didn't experience Judaism as having anything to do at all with connecting to God. I think it's safe to say that today the state of the union of our people is not terribly healthy. We only find a very small percentage of Jewish people today that are really seriously living their lives according to the teachings of Judaism. Probably the vast majority of Jews on the planet today live their lives pretty much disconnected from the basic spiritual teachings of Judaism. At best, Judaism for most people is a civilization, a culture, a heritage, a tradition, an identity, but not much more than that. When God created the world, we're told in the Bible that in the Garden of Eden, there was an Eitz HaChayim, a tree of life, Betoch HaGan. Betoch HaGan, literally in the center, in the midst of the garden. And the Aramaic translation of the Torah, the Targum Unkelis, translates Betoch as in the center. That this tree of life was in the center of the garden. We all know that the tree of life is always compared to the Torah. We say the Torah, Eitz Chaim, here is the tree of life. And so this Eitz Chaim, placed in the center of paradise, is supposed to radiate life, spiritual life, and therefore, since it has to radiate spiritual life, it had to be placed in the center, centrally located. And so too, our hearts are placed in the center of our body. And in the same way that our heart is in the center of the body, the tree of life, the Torah, is in the center of the garden, spirituality has to be the center of our lives. What that means is that we can't compartmentalize our spirituality to be tucked away into a mere corner of our lives. It's not possible to live as spiritual dilettantes. We can't live spiritually as Jews, as hobbyists. We can't do it once in a while. That ultimately, for it to work, it has to be a full-time, serious focus of our lives. We have to be, as one famous Jewish teacher, Dennis Prager, said, serious Jews. When he was asked if he's a religious Jew, he says, I'm a serious Jew. And that's what we should be. We should take it seriously. What is the difference between real spirituality and what people often experience as a very unsatisfying kind of Judaism? I think that the one critical component of real spirituality is that it's real. We have to know that it makes a real difference in our lives. For Jewish spirituality to be real, it has to be an involvement that we understand, that we deeply feel, has some real connection and real impact on the minute-to-minute quality of my life, who I am, how I go through every single day. In the beginning of our Bible, in the book of Genesis, Bereshit, there's a fascinating story where the Torah tells us that Haran, the brother of Abraham, died, the Torah tells us, Bifnei Terach Aviv. Now, this is a very tricky word to translate. I would normally translate Bifnei as in the presence. That Haran died in the presence of Terach, his father. Terach, as we know, is the father of Abraham. And the Bible tells us that the brother of Abraham, Haran, died in the presence of Terach, his father. But Rashi, the very, very world-famous commentary to the Jewish Bible, who lived about 1,000 years ago in France, Rashi translates it as not in the presence of, but on account of, that Haran died because of Terach, his father. How did that happen? Why did Haran die? Because of his father, Terach. So the Midrash tells this very famous story, that Abraham once was asked to take over. His father was a manufacturer of idols, and his father had to go out of town, probably to some kind of idol-making convention, and Abraham was left in charge of all the idols. When the father was gone, Abraham took a big hammer and smashed all the idols. You know, the word iconoclast, right, means destroyer of idols. Abraham was the first destroyer of icons, of these idols. And he left the biggest one intact. When the father came back, the father sees all of his stock, the entire store was destroyed, and he says to Abraham, I put you in charge, what happened? And Abraham says, don't blame me. He says, the idols got into a big fight, and the biggest one picked up a hammer and destroyed everyone else. So the father says, what are you, crazy? These idols can't even move. What are you talking about? They got into a fight, and one destroyed all the other ones. And Abraham says, Father, don't you hear what you're saying? These idols can't do anything. They can't move. They can't fight. They can't pick up even a hammer. Why do you worship them? Why do you pray to them? Abraham's father, Terach, turns Abraham over to Nimrod. Nimrod is the big, bad hombre in the world back then. And Nimrod basically gets into a very big philosophical argument with Abraham as well. Who really runs the world? Is it the sun? Is it the moon? Is it the stars? Is it the wind? Is it the waters? And finally, Nimrod has enough of Abraham, and he decides to throw Abraham into a fiery furnace. Abraham is there with his brother Haran. Abraham is about to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And Haran says to himself, this is going to be interesting. If my brother Abraham comes out alive, then I'll be willing to go into the furnace just like he did. But if Abraham is burnt to a crisp in the furnace, then I'm not going to say I'm on his side. We know what happens. Abraham goes into this furnace. He walks out. Not a hair on his body is singed. His clothing is all intact. An incredible miracle. And Nimrod turns to Haran and says, Nu, what about you? Are you on Abraham's side or not? He says, sure, I'm with my brother Abe. They throw Haran into the furnace, and he's burned to a crisp. Now, it's a cute story, and children that read this, they grow up in Hebrew schools, they learn about this story, but the question is, what is the message here? You know, the Midrash does not just tell us cute stories for the sake of amusement. There's a very, very critical message and lesson that this story conveys. And what is that lesson? The lesson is very simple. The lesson is, why did Abraham go into the furnace? Why did Abraham go into the furnace? And the answer is because for Abraham, God was real. God was the ultimate source of all reality. And for Abraham, that is the only reason he would have gone into that furnace. Because for him, he was in touch with the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. And so he's able to walk into that furnace if that's what is meant to happen to him. But why did Haran go into the furnace? Haran went in because his brother went in. For Haran, it wasn't real. You know, they tell the famous story, and, you know, someone goes to synagogue, and they're very religious, and they pray very hard, and so they ask someone, why do you go to the synagogue? I go to pray to God. And they ask his friend, right, Shlomo, who sits next to him every week, why do you go? He says, I go because my friend is there. Right? Not everybody in the synagogue is there because they're coming to pray. Right? Some people are there because they want to pray, and some people are there because their friends are there. Right? For the ones that are coming to pray, the prayer experience is real. It's deep. It's profound. Other people go to the synagogue and often report that they don't find synagogue very meaningful, very moving, very spiritually uplifting. Because for them, it's not, they're not going into it as a real spiritual experience. They're going in as a social experience. And the truth of the matter is, they might have a better social experience with their friends, not in the synagogue. Maybe going to a ball game or a bar or wherever. So from the Abraham story, we learn that for spirituality to work, it has to be real. Abraham Joshua Heschel once said that if Judaism isn't of ultimate importance, it really isn't that important at all. It's either ultimately important, or if it gets relevated to the level of a hobby or some passing fad, it's not that important. It's either real or it's not real. I often tell the story of a group of law students in Windsor, Ontario that I met with, and they asked me, why is it so important for Jews not to marry non-Jews? They were very puzzled by this Jewish obsession with banning intermarriage. And I said to the woman that asked me the question, I said, you're asking me the wrong question. If you're asking me at this stage in your life why you shouldn't marry a non-Jew, I probably don't have a good answer for you. I said, you're not asking the right question. She said, what was the right question to ask? I said, the right question is not why you shouldn't marry a non-Jew. The right question for you to ask is, why should you be Jewish? If for you being Jewish is meaningful and compelling and profound and energizing, and it's something that you can wrap your entire life around because it's so incredibly deep and meaningful and satisfying and nurturing, I don't have to explain to you why you should marry only a Jew. Because why would you want to share your entire life with someone who doesn't share your most important, serious value, the central value of your life? Why would you want to spend your entire life with someone who doesn't share that with you? But if for you, being Jewish is not that important, if it's not the center of your life, I probably can't give you a good reason why you shouldn't marry a non-Jew. I probably couldn't give you a satisfying or compelling reason. So it's a question, really, of what becomes the center of our lives. Is Judaism the center, the focus of our lives, or is it something that we just relegate to the sidelines? The ultimate question for all of us, all people in the world, to really struggle with and to come to understand is, why are we here? Right? Why are we here in this world? What is the purpose of life? We can ask this question almost, it sounds like a stereotypical, trivial question. What is the meaning of life? It's the kind of question where on Star Trek, Captain Kirk was always asked on every planet he went to by the people he met there, what is love and what is life? What is it all about? It's a very big question. Why are we here? What is the purpose of our lives? And Judaism provides an answer to this question. Judaism teaches us that the primary reason we're in this world can be understood by trying to understand the very first sentence of the Bible. The Bible tells us that the world was created by God. The world is not an accident. There are two possibilities. Either the world we live in is a random collision of particles and molecules, that somehow matter is always here, atoms are floating around, maybe one day there's a big bang, and voila, there's a world. But it's an accident. There's no real intended intrinsic meaning to the world. The world was not created according to this version. The other possibility is that the world was created on purpose, with intended meaning, with intrinsic meaning. So the Bible begins, the very first sentence is that God created everything. God created the heavens and the earth. $64,000 question is why? What was God's intention in creating a world, especially in creating people? Why are we here? And so the traditional answer provided by all Jewish sages and thinkers over history has been to understand God on some level as our parents. Our parents, we think at least on some level, bring us into this world. And the ultimate parent, we speak about God as Avinu Shebashamayim, our parents in heaven. So what do our parents, our terrestrial parents, want for us? What do mommy and daddy want for us? They want for us to be ultimately satisfied and have ultimate pleasure. What every parent wants for their child is for their child to have a fulfilling, ultimately and deeply pleasurable life, to be totally fulfilled, and to have not just pleasure, but to have the greatest pleasure possible. Our parents don't want third-class or second-class pleasure for us. Our parents would like us to have the highest pleasure possible. And so our rabbis, our sages explain that's exactly what God wants for us. God, as an act of creating us out of love, the Torah tells us that creation was an act of love. Olam chesed yibaneh, the book of Psalms says. And so, as an act of love, what God wants to do is give to us. And God, as the ultimate, wants to give us the ultimate. So what is the ultimate pleasure that human beings can have? And I'll give you a clue. It's not chocolate. It's not sitting on the beach in the Bahamas. Although these are pleasures. It's not even looking into the smile of a little baby. It's not appreciating a beautiful sunset. And these are all wonderful pleasures. But we say that these are all pleasures that point beyond themselves. When I was a kid in high school, I had a job once working at Nabisco, where they manufacture wonderful cookies. And I remember I got to eat Fig Newtons off the assembly line. I used to love Fig Newtons. I loved them when I was eating them out of a bag that may have been a year old off of the shelf in the store. And now I was getting to eat them off the assembly line, fresh, as you can imagine. Those were even better. Because the further you go back to the source of something, the better it is. So if we can imagine a world we live in with all these amazing pleasures, they all point beyond themselves to a source of these pleasures. And therefore, the ultimate pleasure that human beings can have is to be able to experience the source of all pleasure in this world, which is God Himself. As the greatest good in the world, being able to attach ourselves to the transcendent, to be able to attach ourselves to God, to have intimacy with God, there is no possible greater pleasure. This is basically the foundational teaching of Judaism. It might even be one of the meanings of the phrase, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. God is not just one God, but God is number one, numero uno. There's nothing more important and more central to our lives than God. This idea, though, of connecting ourselves to God is not that simple. It should be very simple, but in the complicated world we live in, it's not that simple. The Hebrew word for faith, you could say, or belief, or connection to God, is emunah. Emunah is related to two Hebrew words. One is the word umanut, which means art, and the other is the word omenet, which is a nurse. And so for us to really grow our faith, it has to be both crafted and nurtured. Faith has to ultimately be both crafted and nurtured. Talmud tells us that at the end of our lives, after 120 years, there's going to be a final exam. And one of the first questions we're going to be asked is, Nasata v'natata be'emuna. Did you, according to most translations, did you do your business dealings honestly and fairly? Most of the people that translate this phrase understand it to mean a question about our ethics, our ethical lives. When you went through your life, did you deal honestly and fairly in business with people? But one of the great Rebbes, the Tzanzer Rebbe, explained the verse a little bit differently. He said, Nasata v'natata be'emuna, did you do business with your faith? Not did you do your business faithfully, but did you do business with your faith? What does that mean? So it's explained that if a person has $1,000, they're not likely to just put it under their mattress and let it sit there, and in 5 years and have $1,000. A person has $1,000 or $10,000, wants it to grow. So what will they do? They will invest themselves in trying to make their money grow. They might read books on investing. They might speak to financial advisors. They might read the stock reports in the newspapers. They might speak to everyone they meet. How do I grow my money? What do I do to invest it? How do I make it grow? And it's a concern people have. And many people, you all know them, spend a certain amount of energy and their focus mentally during every day of the year on their investments. It's an overriding concern that people have. So the Tzanzer Rebbe said that the first question we're going to be asked after 120 years is, did you do this kind of business with your faith? Meaning, did you go through life and try to grow your faith? You know, when we think about the first of the Ten Commandments, we know we
It should be up there somewhere.
Right? We know that the first one says that we're supposed to have faith in God. So one of the simplest questions that's ever been asked was, how do you do this commandment of having faith in God? On some level, it's a bit strange. Because if a person already believes in God, they don't need to be commanded to believe in God. So the person that already believes in God, what are they supposed to do? How do they fulfill that commandment? And if a person doesn't have faith in God, you can't be commanded. You just can't turn it on and off like a water spigot. So what is the commandment to have faith in God? And our rabbis explained that the commandment is fulfilled by yearning, by seeking, by striving, by trying to develop our faith. The prophet Isaiah says in the 45th chapter, verse 15, you are a God who hides himself. You are a God who hides himself. The holy Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, explained that when a father teaches his son how to walk, as a child approaches, what does the father do? The father might be standing there, the little child is moving forward awkwardly, the little child's arms are outstretched, the father's arms might be outstretched, but then at some point the father might move backwards. It looks counterintuitive. The little boy is trying to walk toward his father, maybe to fall into his father's arms. The father is waiting for him. And yet as the child approaches and gets closer, the father moves away. Why? Because the father, by moving away, is encouraging the child to keep on walking. That's how the father encourages the child to walk and to learn how to walk. Not by moving towards the child, by moving away from the child. And so sometimes the prophet Isaiah tells us that God hides himself. He seems to withdraw from our lives. He seems to move away, not as a sign of rejection, but to arouse us to intensify our seeking after him. They tell a wonderful story about this old man who sees a little boy sitting on the floor of the street. He's sitting on the curb. The little boy is crying. He looks so upset and so rejected and so depressed. And the old man walks over to him and says, why are you crying? What's wrong? So the little boy says, you know, my friends and I went out to play hide and go seek. And my friends told me that you should go and hide. So he said, I went and I hid. I found a great hiding place. But after 3 or 4 hours, I realized no one was coming to find me. So the old man sat down next to the boy and the old man started crying. So the little boy turns to the old man and says, why are you crying? And the old man says, you know, that's exactly what's going on with God. God tells us that he's hiding in the world. The word in Hebrew for world, olam, means hidden. Because God is hidden in the world. We don't live in a world where you could see God. And so God wants us to look for him and to try to find him. And so many people are not doing that. So the old man joined the little boy and started crying. The Torah describes this kind of possible intimacy and closeness with God as devekut or devekus. That's the word that the Bible uses to describe what we're able to do in terms of connecting with God. It's an extremely powerful and extremely moving kind of a word. It's the word that the Bible uses in the beginning of Genesis when it says, therefore every man must leave his father and mother, vidavak va'ishto, and cleave, attach himself to his wife. So the very same word that the Bible uses to describe that most intense kind of bonding between a man and a woman, that's the word the Bible uses to describe our relationship to God. And as you all know, we just read this book on Passover. We read the book Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, which is an extremely erotic and beautiful love poem about a man and a woman, two lovers. And our rabbis teach us that this poem, this song, Shir HaShirim, is basically a poem, a song describing the relationship between the Jewish people and God, or between each individual and God. But that's the potential that's locked up in our lives. We have that potential to bind ourselves to God. The word devek in modern Hebrew means glue. We can literally glue ourselves to God. But the question is, how do we develop this kind of closeness? How do we cultivate this kind of relationship? Well, what happens in any human relationship? How do two people get close to each other? What is one of the most important ingredients in developing a relationship? So communication is obviously one of the most central features. And so one of the things that we do to be able to cultivate closeness to God is by listening to God. Rabbi Norman Lamb wrote a wonderful book about the spirituality of the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel. And Norman Lamb explained that one of the meanings of this line, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. He explains it as Shema Yisrael, listen Israel, listen you Jews. Listen to who? Listen to Adonai Eloheinu. That's how he explains the Shema. The Shema as a directive, just encouraging us to always be listening to God. Why? Because Adonai Echad, because God is one, there's really nothing else in the world but God. Every single thing in the universe really speaks on behalf of God. God is always speaking to us because God is one. There is nothing else in the world. And so if we pay attention to everything in our lives, we can be listening to God. It builds incredible closeness to pay that kind of close attention to God. Maimonides explains, for example, one of the most powerful ways of listening to God is by looking very deeply, focusing on the world around us, the world of nature. After all, the Bible calls God Sur Olamim, often translated as the Rock of Ages, but the Hebrew word for an artist is a tsayar, a painter. And so God is Sur Olamim, He's the painter of this world. The world we live in is a masterpiece. It's an incredibly beautiful masterpiece. And Maimonides tells us that if we want to develop a closeness to God and a love of God and a passion for God, Maimonides advises us, study science. Look at the complexity of the world. Look at the beauty of the world. And so often, we just drive right by and we don't pay attention. There's beauty in front of us almost all the time. I went to New York for Passover, and my friend that I was staying with is a birder. He's in love with birds. And I can walk down the street and sometimes not even notice the birds are chirping, or it's just a lot of noise. I wouldn't know one bird from another. And we're walking down the street together, he's identifying 10, 15 kind of birds just as we walked a few minutes to the synagogue. To him, it was a symphony, a beautiful, delicious, delightful symphony, if we pay attention, if we open ourselves up to it. And the same thing with everything that we experience. The world is such a beautiful, delicious place, but we have to pay attention. We have to open our eyes. There's incredible beauty all around us. And obviously, the more we get into nature, the more beautiful it is. We live in a world where so much of what we see is man-made. When you go out into the world of nature, you don't see anything made by human beings. Everything you see is created by the Almighty. That's the kind of experience that we're able to develop incredible closeness to the Creator. We're seeing His masterpieces in front of us at all times. There's a wonderful book written, I mentioned before, Arthur Kurzweil's book, Driving with Rabbi Steinsaltz. This is a book written called Walking with Rabbi Miller. Rabbi Avigdor Miller, one of the great rabbis that passed away a number of years ago, had someone that used to walk with him all the time. His doctors recommended for his health that he walk for an hour a day. One of his students was very smart and said, "What a great opportunity. I'm going to walk with the rabbi every day." And he published a wonderful book describing the things they discussed on these walks. So one of the most amazing passages is where he says, on one of our walks, the Rebbe shared what he called the highest spiritual experience he had in his life. Imagine the great Rabbi Avigdor Miller describing the highest spiritual experience he had in his life. He described how when he was learning in the Slabodka Yeshiva in Europe, during the summer break, he occasionally hiked in the Lithuanian hills and fields, indulging in the joy of coming close to God's creation in its natural state. On one of those excursions, he sat and stared at a flower, analyzing its components, appreciating its beauty, and basking in the brilliant warmth of God's infinite wisdom. The Rebbe explained to me that he sat preoccupied this way for an hour. That's not so easy to do, to sit and appreciate the beauty of a flower for an hour. I think many of us might get a little bit tired after a few moments. But Rabbi Miller sat there for an hour just looking and meditating and delving deeply, looking very deeply at this flower. The Rebbe explained to me that he sat preoccupied this way for an hour. When he was finished, he had an awesome feeling of closeness with God and saw the divine hand in creation with an outstanding clarity. He then added that this was to such an extent that it actually came close to nevuah, to prophecy. This contemplation, the Rebbe said, produced the greatest spiritual experience he had ever had in his life, and it led him to supreme heights. That kind of experience is available to all of us. Another way of listening to God is by listening to the way God speaks to us in the daily occurrences of our lives. Again, it's something that happens to us all the time that we often don't pay attention to. Rabbi Yaakov Haber, who used to run a wonderful Torah institution in Buffalo, New York, got married and lived with his young wife in Jerusalem, I think in the Mattersdorf section of Jerusalem. And he tells an amazing story that as he was just married, maybe a few months later came the holiday of Hanukkah. There's a knock on the door just as he's about to light the Hanukkah candles. And at the door, there's a very poor, disheveled person, a pauper, that asked if he can come in, watch them light the Hanukkah candles. And they, of course, let him in. And then he asked them, after they finished lighting the candles, can he come back? They said, certainly. And he ended up coming back once a week to have his clothing washed, to get a meal. Started coming back twice a week, maybe three times a week. And he was coming back for months and months and months and months. And they probably thought, this is a wonderful thing. They're helping this fellow who certainly needs help. But then after their baby was born, they realized they probably needed a larger apartment. And they moved from Mattersdorf to, I think, the Romema neighborhood, the old bus station neighborhood in Jerusalem. And they never bothered telling this fellow Beinish where they were moving. One day, Rabbi Haber's wife notices, after she puts the baby to sleep, a scorpion running across the floor of the room that the baby's in. She, of course, freaks out, and she calls her husband, and it's upsetting. You know, a scorpion in Jerusalem, they're very dangerous. The next night, they notice two scorpions. So they try to take measures to maybe lift the crib off the floor and cover the crib. They wanted to make sure no scorpion gets into the baby's crib. They finally called an exterminator. The exterminator set some traps and put out poison. It didn't help. The scorpions kept on coming back. He asked them, did anyone else in the neighborhood have a problem with scorpions? They asked around all their friends and neighbors. No one else in the neighborhood had a problem with scorpions. This is getting very strange, very weird. Finally, they couldn't figure it out. They couldn't get rid of the scorpions. Rabbi Haber said he's going to ask his Rebbe. His Rebbe was the famous Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, who just passed away a few weeks ago at the age of 101. An amazing, amazing rabbi. He went to see his Rebbe and he said, Rebbe, I have a really weird thing going on in our home. We have these scorpions, they're all over the place. The exterminator can't get rid of them. No one else in the building has scorpions. What's happening? Rabbi Scheinberg said, you know, let's look in the Perek Shira. The Perek Shira is a little tiny book that describes the songs, that 85, I think, different things that were created by God, the songs that they sing. Every thing that was created sings its own song. Each have our own song. And so they opened up the book, and the book spoke about the song of the scorpion. Scorpion has its song as well. What was the song of the scorpion? It says, Tov Adonai Lakol, V'rachamav Al Kol Ma'asav. God is good to all, and His mercies are upon all creatures. Sounds like a strange song for the scorpion. Rabbi Scheinberg asked Rabbi Haber, maybe there's a message here that maybe when it comes to being kind to others, there's something wrong in your life. And Rabbi Haber is trying to think, no, we're good people. My wife and I, we give charity, we help people. What do you mean that there's a problem with our being kind to people? And then it hit him like a thunderbolt. Oh my God. Banish. We never told Banish we were moving. This man came to rely upon us. We were taking care of him so many times a week. And we just left without telling him where we were going. I've got to find Banish. So poor Rabbi Haber is running all over Jerusalem to find this Banish. Banish didn't have a phone up, obviously. Right, Haber's feeling very desperate. One day, a big miracle happens. He's on the bus in Jerusalem, and he sees Banish down the street. He gets off the bus. He runs after Banish. He says, Banish, oh, it's so nice to see you. We've been missing you. We're very sorry we didn't tell you where we lived. Here's our new address in Romema. Please come and visit us. Banish, of course, comes the next day. He shows up. That day, no more scorpions. He disappeared. Now, we could think that these kind of events in our lives, and even smaller events, they're coincidences, it's just serendipity, it's just the way things happen. But the truth is that God speaks to us through the events of our lives. There are no coincidences. There was a series of books written by two wonderful women called Small Miracles, giving hundreds of stories where in our daily lives, God is tapping us on the shoulder. He's whispering in our ear. But we have to be open to hearing it. If we're not open, we're not going to hear anything. But one of the ways we build closeness to God is by just opening up our ears, listening, paying attention. Shema Yisrael, listen, Jews. Open your ears. The Talmud says that every single day, a voice comes out of heaven. God sends a bat kol, a voice out of heaven. And it complains about the Jewish people sometimes that we don't really pay attention to God. So the Baal Shem Tov asked a very famous question. What's the use of this bat kol, of this heavenly voice, if no one hears it? So why is God sending a voice from heaven if no one hears it? Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, the great Hasidic Rebbe, explained that that voice does come to all of us. All of us have moments during our week, during our day, where we have an inner voice, a moment of inspiration, a thought that comes to us, a moment of clarity. And he explains that these are not always coming just all by themselves. Sometimes God sends to us thoughts. Some of the thoughts that come up in our own mind were put there by God. Or it could be an inspiration that hits us, right? These are gifts that we're getting from God, and it helps us to pay attention to the fact we should be thankful. Thank you, God, for sending me that. Thank you, God, for sending me that. Aside from listening to God, the other side of communication is not just listening, but speaking. We have to speak with God. The Noam Elimelech, the great Hasidic master, says that the word for prayer in Hebrew, tefillah, comes from the root word meaning to connect. That prayer is for the purpose of connecting ourselves to God. Ultimately, we don't go to the synagogue to pray. We go to the synagogue because we are people of prayer. King David says in the Psalms, Va'ani tefillah, I am prayer. Prayer is really not just something we do, prayer is who we are. Prayer is who we are. The word Yehudi, a Jew, comes from the word to praise God. And so, prayer is not simply picking up a book and reading words. Prayer is basically speaking to God. And Rabbi Nachman of Breslov would advise people, one of the most powerful things that we can do spiritually is simply talk to God. If you saw Fiddler on the Roof, you know that Tevye did it all the time. He would speak to God. Because if God's in your life, of course you're going to speak to Him. And if you don't feel God in your life, speak to Him, and you'll begin feeling His presence. So prayer, speaking to God, conversing with God, thanking God, asking things of God, these are all ways of building this kind of intimacy. The Talmud speaks about another way of building closest to God. Actually, the Talmud, when it speaks about this verse in the Bible that we should attach ourselves to God, right? Dvekut, to attach ourselves, the Talmud says, how can you do that? God is a flaming fire. Meaning that the Talmud seems to feel that it's a little bit not so easy to attach ourselves to God. So the approach the Talmud gives is to say the following. We can attach ourselves to God and build closeness to God by imitating God. You know, if you study psychology today, neuro-linguistic programming basically suggests that one of its techniques for building rapport is to mirror people. Right? If you're speaking to someone and they are speaking with a low tone of voice, they're not raising their voice, so you lower your voice as well. If they're sitting in a relaxed manner, let's say leaning back and their arms folded, you should do the same thing. That when we mirror people and we pattern ourselves after them, the communication to them is, hey, I'm just like you. And so not only does it work in psychology, but spiritually, the Talmud says that one of the most powerful ways of getting close to God is by trying to pattern our lives after God. So the Talmud says, if God is giving, we can become or should become giving people. And the more giving we become, the more like God we become. And if God is patient and merciful, that's what we should do. We should become people who are patient and merciful, and specifically think about doing it for the purpose of getting close to God. We should consciously say, I am doing this. I am acting in a godly way because I want to become more close to God. I want to imitate God because I desire to be closer to God. Abraham, we know in the beginning of Genesis, was once visited by God after his circumcision. The Bible tells us that God came to visit him. God appeared to Abraham. It's an amazing thing. You know, imagine someone that wants to be close to God and all of a sudden God shows up in the living room. You don't get better than that. And immediately after God shows up to visit Abraham, you would think it's the apex of a spiritual experience. Abraham notices there are three strangers in the distance. He says to God, excuse me, God, click. I'm going to have to put you on hold for a little while. I got to take care of those guys. It seems very strange. If the ultimate experience in life is getting close to God, and here Abraham is literally communing with God. God is there visiting him. So what is the sense of saying to God, God, later, I'll get back to you, and going off and doing something else? And the answer is very simple. That when Abraham is being visited by God, his experience with God is very passive. He's just there and God is visiting him. But he understands that an even deeper spiritual experience is not simply being passive and having God in your presence. It's actively becoming yourself more God-like. So Abraham now jumps at the opportunity of nourishing, of sustaining, of feeding people, because that's what God does to all of us. God nourishes and sustains and feeds the world. Abraham now is not doing something that's on a lower spiritual level. By imitating God and becoming more godly, he's getting even closer to God. And that's why the Talmud says that hachnasas orchim, welcoming guests into your house, is yoter mikabalat pnei ashchina. It's greater than even welcoming the divine presence into your house. When you take care of guests and you nourish people, you're going to the highest spiritual level possible. Yitzchak Buxbaum, the famous Jewish Magid, storyteller, has an amazing teaching. Yitzchak Buxbaum says that one of the strangest stories in the Bible is when God creates human beings. If you think about it, it's pretty bizarre. The Bible says that God, so to speak, if you want to think about it this way, bends down, picks up a whole bunch of dirt from the ground, and shapes it into a human form, and then breathes the breath of life into it. But it's sort of very strange to imagine God taking the earth, taking schmutz, dirt, clay, and forming it into the shape of a human being. And Buxbaum asks the question, what does this look like? What scene does this look like when the Bible describes God as taking clay and earth and forming it into the shape of a man? When a human being makes an idol, we take clay and we shape it into a form that we assume is God. And it's interesting that the same word is used for an idol and for God's creation of the human being. When the Torah says that God made us out of the earth, it says that God made us Bitzelem Elohim, in the image of God. The word Selem is the word used for idols. What do we learn from this story? So Buxbaum says something amazing. He says, think about it. There are two stories here. You have God making the human being an idol, a tselem, and we have the human being that makes a little god, an idol, a tselem. So Buxbaum says that the lesson, the take-home lesson of the story is, God's teaching us something very strong. God's teaching us, if you want to get close to me, don't serve what you make in my image. That's what an idol is. An idol is what human beings make, what we think is the image of God. God's saying to us, if you want to get close to me, don't serve what you make in my image. Serve what I made in my image. What did God make in His image? Human beings. So the Torah is starting out, at the very beginning of Genesis, God is saying, that's how we can get close to God. By serving that which God made in His image. And not to serve what we often think is the image of God. Let's go a little bit deeper. When we think about getting close to God, we're ultimately becoming more of ourselves. I mentioned before that when God created us, He took this clump of earth and He breathed the breath of life into that physical form. A human being by nature is spiritual. The Bible says that we are called Adam. The human being is called Adam. Why? Because we were taken from the Adama, from the earth. A human being is called Adam because we were taken from the earth. But the rabbis teach us there's another reason why we're called Adam. Because Adama, earth, can also be read as Edameh. I can resemble. I can be like. Meaning that we're called Adam because we have the potential to be like God. We can resemble God. And if you were here for the Aleph-Bet class, we learned that the numerical value of Adam, the numerical value of the Hebrew word Adam is 45. And 45 is the numerical value of God's four-letter name to the power. Meaning if you take each letter of God's intrinsic name, the Yud, He, Vav, He, and you spell out Yud, Yud, Vav, Dalet, He, He, Aleph, and you spell out all the letters in God's name, those letters add up to 45. So God at His, let's say, ultimate name equals 45, and Adam, Aleph, Dalet, Mem, is 45, because the human being can be like God. And therefore God commands us in the Bible, Kadoshim Tiyu, you shall be holy, Ki Kadosh Ani, as I am holy. God tells us we have the potential to be like Him. Ultimately, by getting close to God, we're really getting close to who we are at our core. I've sometimes told a cute story that when I went to the bar mitzvah of one of my cousins, my sister noticed I was having a horrible time. Because there were go-go dancers, it just didn't feel right to me. She saw me sitting there, and she came over to torture me more. And my sister asked me, Michael, who sang the song Winchester Cathedral? So I was sitting there maybe for an hour and a half. This is, no one had handheld Google capabilities at that time. And it was just driving me crazy. I sat there and I sat there and I sat there. I couldn't remember. I could sing the song. I couldn't remember who sang this song. But I said to my sister, Sherry, if you would have given me a multiple choice test, right, given me four different possible answers, I would definitely have gotten it right. I mean, that I would be able to definitely recognize the group if it was in front of me. But I'm just not able to dredge it out of myself. I couldn't just yank it out of my hard drive. I know that it was back there somewhere, but I couldn't bring it out. And basically, when it comes to our spiritual nature, being spiritual is not something that we have to invent. It's not something we have to try to somehow grab from a faraway place. Being spiritual is literally who we are at our cores. The Sfas Emes, the second Gera Rebbe, asked a very famous question. How could the Bible command us to love God? It's one of the mitzvot. One of the commandments is Ahavat Hashem, to love God. We say it in the Shema. V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your might. How could you have a command to love God? You can't turn on emotions. So the Sfas Emes explained that really, the love of God is something that is deeply embedded inside of us. It's again who we are by nature. And the commandment is not to create an emotion that's not there. The commandment of loving God is to engage in the kinds of actions that will allow this innate love to come out. It's there. You don't have to manufacture it. We by nature, by default, love God. So the commandment for us is to do two things. Number one, that love often gets clouded over. It gets occluded. It gets stopped up. There are barnacles that grow over it. So one thing we're commanded to do is to remove the occlusions to our love of God. To remove those things that get in the way. And secondly, to do the kind of things that would nurture that which is there anyway innately. The Talmud teaches us that while we're infants in the uterus of our mommies, an angel comes and teaches us the entire Torah. That we are taught everything there is to know spiritually before we're born. And then as we're born, an angel smacks us on our lip, and that's why we have that little indentation there. I'm not sure if there's a name for that. I never heard a name for it. But we're told that as the angel strikes us on the lip, we forget all of our Torah. And when we learn Torah, one of the reasons it's so pleasurable is because it's a deja vu experience. We have a sense that we knew it, we heard it before, and I'm recapturing something that really is innately part of myself. Unfortunately, there are barriers to our spiritual growth. There are many things that get in the way of our ability and progress in growing spiritually. Probably one of the most serious things is we get distracted by the physical, mundane world that we're surrounded by. And it's impossible to serve two masters. It's impossible to really focus ourselves on the spiritual when we're so caught up in the physical. The Talmud tells us in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, that one of the miracles that took place every day in the temple was that the fires on the altar were never extinguished by the rains. It would rain in Israel. Maybe not every day. But one of the miracles was that when it rained, the rains didn't put out the fire on the altar. Now the word for rain in Hebrew is geshem. Geshem is related to the Hebrew word for physicality, gashmiut. And so some of the rabbis explain that what the teaching is saying here is that it's a miracle if geshem, if gashmiut, if the world of the physical doesn't extinguish the flame on our altar. A heart is supposed to be an altar to God. Bilvavi mishkan evne. In my heart I build a sanctuary. A heart is supposed to be a place that's flaming with passion for God. And yet the gashmiut, the physicality of this world, the kind of consumeristic world we live in, of acquiring and buying and having more and more and more and more, that can't coexist with passion for the spiritual. And so it takes a miracle for the physicality not to extinguish the spiritual. The Talmud says in Tractate Psachim, the tractate dealing with the laws of Passover, that only someone who owned land in the land of Israel had to make aliyat regel. The Torah commands us that three times a year the Jews had to go to Jerusalem for each of the pilgrim festivals. Everyone had to go up to Jerusalem. But the Talmud says if you didn't own land, you didn't have to go. So the Kutzker Rebbe explained, why is it that a person who didn't own land didn't have to go and make aliyat regel to Jerusalem? He says because the person didn't need to. Only the person that was preoccupied with having land and being involved with the physical, and being involved with his possessions, and being involved with the land, that person needed the corrective of going to Jerusalem 3 times a year to get a heavy dose of spirituality in the temple in Jerusalem. But the person who didn't have land, that wasn't tied down to the physical, didn't need to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year. They're not encumbered by the gashmius, by the physicality. The Midrash says in the book of Koheles Rabbah, Ecclesiastes, the following: no person leaves this world having achieved even half of their material aspirations. A person that has $100 wants $200. The person that has $200 wants $400. That's the nature of the beast. And the Dugna Magid asked the question, where does this insatiable appetite come from? That's the way we are. We're hardwired that we always want more. We're never satisfied with what we have. We have a 2-room house. We're plotting to have a 3-room house. People are just like that. Where does it come from? The Dugna Magid said that, you know, if you look at the animal world, the world of animals, they will eat what they need to eat and they stop when they're finished. You don't see animals overeating. Human beings have this potential to just eat way beyond what they need to eat. Only human beings indulge to excess. Animals don't do that. Why does that happen? So the Magid explains that human beings are unique in that we have an insatiable drive for spirituality. We have an insatiable thirst and hunger for spirituality, of growing close to God. And this is insatiable because God is infinite. You can't satisfy this because God is infinite. But what happens is we don't always correctly identify the source of that thirst, the source of that hunger. We just know that deep down inside we feel we want. We feel we have to have. It's a yearning. It's a sense that I just have to have more and more and more and more. We don't realize that what it's really calling out for us is to have more spirituality, to have more of God. But we hear this little voice of I want, I desire, and we don't identify it properly, and sometimes we try to fill that craving with physical things, physical pleasures. And we all know that these will never satisfy us. And that's why if we have 100, we want 200. The Midrash says that it's like the princess who marries a pauper. And this pauper tries to make her happy. And he thinks he's going to buy her a nice carnation or a nice bunch of flowers. And he doesn't realize she's a princess. She once lived in a palace where there were huge gardens. There were whole forests with all of nature around for her. She's not going to be satisfied with a small little flower, with a little tiny bouquet. So in the same way, we have a soul that is infinite. And the soul will never be satisfied with simple physical things. It's just not going to happen. The Stifler Rebbe explained that if you see a child dressed in clothing where the arms of the jacket come down to here and the pant legs are 3 feet too long, you know for sure that the child is wearing his father's suit. So too, he says, when you think about the enormity of our minds, think about the incredible enormity of the human mind that is able to grasp spiritual ideas and relate to spiritual concepts. It's absurd to think that this great mind, this great potential was given to us for just pursuing mundane pleasures. There has to be much, much more, much higher goals. We're discussing now what some of the barriers to spiritual growth. One of the greatest barriers is just not striving for it. Rav Simcha Bunim of Peshitsa once pointed to a group of Jews, and he told the students that those Jews were spiritually dead. The students didn't understand. The students asked their Rebbe, why are they spiritually dead? So Rav Simcha Bunim said, they're dead because they've stopped asking questions and seeking answers. They're no longer asking questions and seeking answers. And the students got very upset and they asked the Rebbe, how do we know that we're not dead? And he says, because you asked. But ultimately, Rabbi Saul Salanter explained that being a Jew, even being a human being, in terms of spiritual growth, is like being a bird. And if you stop flapping your wings, you're going to fall down. That the experience of growing spiritually is one that we have to constantly be working on. I'll conclude with one final area that I think gets in the way for so many of us. And it's the feeling that, it's the overwhelming feeling that we have, that you know what, this spiritual enterprise sounds nice, it sounds attractive, it sounds appealing, we're maybe interested in it, but we get scared of it. We get terrified of it. Because we sometimes think that it's an all or nothing proposition. We sometimes think that either I'm going to have to lose myself entirely and give up everything for it, or why bother? Why bother? The Chafetz Chaim once gave a wonderful analogy. He said, imagine someone tells you that right outside of the synagogue here, there's a street a block away, and it's a big street, but the street is filled with diamonds. Filled with diamonds. And you're told that you're going to have 15 minutes to pick up all the diamonds on that street. So the Chafetz Chaim said, who's going to say 15 minutes? Never going to happen. Why bother? No one's going to say that. You're going to go for those 15 minutes and grab as much as you can grab. And if you don't grab everything, so what? You grabbed a lot of diamonds. About 200 years ago, in the house of study of Rav Pinchas of Karetz, one of the Baal Shem Tov students, on Simchas Torah, one of his students was very depressed. And Rav Pinchas saw this student looking very despondent on Simchas Torah. And he asked the student, what's wrong? What's wrong? It's supposed to be the happiest day of the year. And he says to his student, what's the problem? And the student said, Rebbe, I'm very sorry, but you know, every single year on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the days of awe, the holy days of awe, I resolve to become a better person. I resolve to grow spiritually. I resolve to change my ways. I resolve to try and really succeed in spiritual ways. And every year, I fall back to my old ways. It's been like this every single year. Come the high holidays, I'm all inspired. I get all worked up. I make all these fancy resolutions. I have all these great plans. I'm going to be such a great spiritual person. And maybe for a little while after Yom Kippur, I'm able to keep it up. But then after a few weeks, I'm back to the same way I was last year. I get sucked right back into life. So why should I be happy? He said to his Rebbe, it's very depressing. So Rav Pinchas said to him the following. I want to tell you something. He says, once the Cossacks came to a town, and they took away many of the young Jewish boys to serve in the Russian army. But they wouldn't go right into the Russian army. The Cossacks would take them and put them into a prison for 1 year. They'd have to be all locked up in a prison for 1 year. It's a horrible place to be for these young men. But once a week, when they were in this prison, during that year, they had 5 minutes where they're able to go outside of the prison walls and walk around the prison compound. And during those 5 minutes, you know what happened? All the townspeople, all the bubbies and zadies and all the mommies and daddies and all the brothers and all the aunts and uncles and all the cousins, they would gather and they'd go up on the roofs of their houses and they would try and peek into the courtyard of this prison to see, catch a glimpse of their son or brother or grandson just for a few moments. And the Rebbe said, isn't that absurd? Isn't that crazy? What's the point of going and trying to catch a glimpse of their son or grandson or brother just for a few moments? They're going to be back in the prison after that. They're going to go right back to the prison. We're not going to be able to see them anymore. Even so, Rav Pinchas said, for those 5 minutes, it's worth it. Even if they can't see you, even if your son doesn't even know that you're there, for 5 minutes to be able to see them walking around in the fresh air, there's nothing more delicious than that. So too, he said to his student, even if you're going to return to your old ways, why should you rejoice today? The Rebbe said, because to have 5 minutes of clarity, 5 minutes of focus, 5 minutes of inspiration, even if afterwards you're going to return to the way it used to be, it's worthwhile for you to have those 5 minutes. And it gives God so much pleasure to see you during those 5 minutes. We say in the Shema, when we say our Shema every day, that we should take God's words and put them upon our hearts. Right? We should take God's words and put them, Al Avecha, upon our hearts. And the Kutzker Rebbe asked, isn't that a strange thing to ask for? Where would we want to put those words of God? If I was writing the Torah, I would say, we should place them into our heart. What do you mean, place them on top of our heart? In the same way, I think George Collins said when he was going to go on the airplane one day, they said to him, you want to get on the plane? He said, no, I want to get in the plane. You can get on the plane. You and Evel Knievel. So the Kutzker Rebbe said, what a strange thing to say that we want to have the words of God, the words of the Torah upon our hearts. So the Kutzker explained that the truth is, you can't give yourself an artificial heart transplant spiritually. You can't somehow manufacture a heart where you implant into your heart spirituality. But you can cover your heart with spirituality. You can cover your heart with words of Torah. You can cover your heart with your aspirations and your desires. And the Kutzker Rebbe said, you know what? Every single one of us, once in a while, during our lifetime, our heart cracks. It breaks open. Right? Every one of us goes through these experiences where we become a little bit more open. Our heart cracks open a little bit. And when the heart opens at that point, those words that are sitting on top of the heart fall right into it. So when we want to think about catching the spirit of Jewish spirituality, we could speak about it, and believe me, for months and months and years to come, because ultimately, as our rabbis teach us, everything in Judaism is spiritual. We don't see it. But every single experience in Judaism, the rabbis say that the purpose of every commandment in the Torah is to attach ourselves to God. That's the meaning of the word of mitzvah. Mitzvah means attachment. It's not just commandment. Every single thing we do in Judaism is to get closer to God. That's why we just finished the Passover Seder. Right, we say at the beginning of the Seder, V'chol ha'marabe l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim. Anyone who increases, who goes beyond and speaks about the Exodus from Egypt, harei zeh meshubach. This person is more praiseworthy. Because as we sing in the Psalms, we say in the Hallel that we say on all the holidays, he'emanti ki adaber. I have faith and therefore I'll speak about it. And so a person who really has that kind of connection, we speak about those things that we love. We don't keep it to ourselves. If you love a particular artist, if you love a particular food, anything that you love, you very naturally speak about it. And so at the Passover Seder, when we connect ourselves to God, Passover is the source of our faith in God. The rabbis teach us that when we came out of Egypt, we as a Jewish people were electrically aware of God's presence. Electrically aware of His presence. After going through the 10 plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea and marching through the desert, we became so aware of God's presence that Passover takes that experience and makes us go through it every single year so that we intensify and fortify and nourish our faith. And so at the Seder, when we feel that we've come out of Egypt, we have to speak about it. And so the Haggadah says, V'chol ha'marbe l'saper, the more we speak about the Exodus, harei zeh meshubach, this person is demonstrating how much faith they have. Ultimately, every single thing that we do as Jews is for that purpose. We have someone leaving the room now. The purpose of that mezuzah standing there, right between this room and the next room, is for us to just pause for a moment. and think about what's the message written in that mezuzah. It's not just a habit, like you hypnotize someone and they kiss something on the way in or out of the room. That's supposed to get us to think and meditate for a few moments. Every single thing we do as Jews is for the purpose of ultimately connecting us to God, raising ourselves up spiritually, growing spiritually. Everything is spiritual. If we just begin to think about that and realize that, we're catching the spirit of Jewish spirituality.